I'd like to welcome our listeners to another episode of Passports, Please, conversations about the power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. And Rodney, I'd have to say today, this is the most exciting place to be.
Yeah,
so we're going to really look forward to this conversation.
Yeah, the conversation's getting better and better, and I'm super excited about this one. So.
Today our very special guest is Matt Sorum. And there's no place to start with you, Matt, without going to 10 other places, but an iconic drummer of just iconic rock and roll bands, and the drummer for Guns N' Roses, Velvet Revolver, Cult, and a whole bunch of other groups that I'm looking forward to learning more about, because in all transparency, Matt, that was the era that I was listening to George Strait and the Carpenters. So this is going to be a lot of fun for me.
But I was listening to this. So,
And a six-time Grammy Award nominee and a one-time winner. So let's just start with that and jump into this conversation. And Rodney, I think you had a few opening questions for Matt.
Well, I don't know. I feel like it's like you say, knowing where to start. You go to Matt's website, and it's just, you're doing so many things and so many projects. I guess that's my main thing, is you seem to be the creator of most of the things that you're involved with. I mean, you started, before the Cult, you did a project, you were with Tori Amos. Was that right?
Yeah. Well, I came up in the club circuit, in Hollywood in the 70s. And I moved up here in 1979 to LA. And,
because you're from California, right?
Yeah. When I say up, I came from Southern California.
Yeah.
And I grew up in kind of a pretty quintessential suburban town. Every third house was the same. In a community called Mission Viejo, which was one of sort of the early developments of like suburban communities in the 60s, right?
Yeah.
And so grew up in that kind of a thing. And then came to Hollywood, started sneaking up to Hollywood in the mid-70s in high school,
Because you were playing drums even in high school, weren't you? And you
high school.
I talk about this because, we can get into it later, but I'm very involved in education, public schools. I have my own charity. But I grew up in a time before something we had out here in California called Proposition 13, which really gave a lot more sort of creative curricular activities to kids in those days. I could take band class, wood shop, metal shop. I took band,
I took wood shop. So.
I think I never even heard of wood shops even still around.
No, it's not.
It's not, actually.
My project in junior high wood shop was a crossbow.
Oh.
And I still have it.
That's pretty serious, Rodney. No birdhouses for you, right?
No.
But, if you kind of even look back, there was a bit of a trade in that, like a trade school kind of thing. They had automotive class. But I gravitated towards music.
Yeah.
That's all I cared about. It was the 70s, the greatest era of music.
Exactly.
All the greatest bands. So anyway, ended up in Hollywood. And then met Tori Amos when I was in a top 40 band at the Marriott Airport Hotel. I used to play in the lounge. And she was in the piano bar. And I heard her play. And I walked up to her and I said, "Who are you? And what planet are you from?" And we started a band.
Really?
And we got signed. She lived behind a little church in a small little house on Franklin Boulevard, right on Vine Street. And I gravitated towards her. I played with her for a couple of years. And then we got signed to Atlantic Records by a gentleman named Jason Flom. And then what happened was they basically signed her as a solo artist, and the rest of us didn't really know much about it. And we were free agents at that point. We were kind of cut loose, which is a good thing in retrospect. Looking back at the time, it was very devastating because I spent a couple years of my life working with her. And then I kind of got the first sort of slap in the face in the music business, if you will.
Yeah.
It's going to be a tough road to navigate with these music business types. So after that, I spent another couple years in label deals, both of which kind of didn't do well. And then I learned again that the music business wasn't going to be easy. You can get a record deal. That wasn't as hard in those days as it is now. You can get one, but then you got to sell records. So I used to say, I got a record deal to my friends. Yeah.
Yes, and?
And then that meant, well, now you got to sell some. I had a couple of hard knocks along the way in the beginning, but then I joined a band called The Cult in the late 80s. And I decided I'm going to stop trying to put together my own bands. It's too painful. I decided to just go out and find a moving target. There was a train going by and I was going to jump on.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, The Cult was a big band.
Yeah. How long had The Cult been going when you joined in?
They started in the 80s, but I joined in 88. Okay. So they'd just come out of a record called Electric, which actually took America by storm. You know, in that particular era in Hollywood, that was, you know, hair metal. That was like Motley Crue, you know, Guns N' Roses had already come out.
Yeah, because you toured like that 40. Sonic Temple, right?
And I didn't really gravitate. You know, obviously I had long hair, but I didn't really like. I mean, there's pictures of me where I got crazy hair and some makeup and all that stuff. Because in those days, you had to almost sort of morph as a musician on the physical presentation as it was to be a good musician. You had to have all the elements. You couldn't come in there looking like a librarian and be the drummer in a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
You know, you had to be like, you had to have the full palette, if you will. And so Auditory Amos, I had this sort of like flock of seagulls.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, now it's grow your hair. Anyway, The Cult came along and I just really thought that band was cool.
Yeah.
I heard they were looking for a drummer and I found a way to get in there. And luckily they took my audition, because that was another thing. Just to get an audition, you had to be recommended by somebody or you had to have some sort of a resume. You know, like I played for Billy Idol in 96. I did some stuff with him and I remember telling him, hey, man, you know, I tried to audition for you in 86, but your manager wouldn't give me the time.
Really?
So it was hard, you know, for a musician to get recognized. But luckily, I got that break. I got and I joined the band. I toured the world. And then fast forward to the next band, which was Guns N' Roses. And I'll let you guys ask the next question.
Well, yeah, that's – yeah, because Slash was the one that – I guess found you, right? He was he at a Cult show?
The Cult took Guns N' Roses out on tour, their first tour. The
okay, that's what it was. All right.
So when I joined the band, Slash and Duff came to visit us, you know, and I never met the guys.
Mm-hmm.
They came to our show and basically stormed in there like a couple of hooligans they were at the time.
Yeah. It's just, they still are, aren't they?
Yeah, in those days, I was, you know, a little younger and maybe a little stronger. Mm-hmm. And The Cult was my band. I mean, probably a lot, if people ask me today what was probably the best fit for me as a drummer, it'd probably be The Cult.
Really?
But so Slash offered me the gig over the phone after he got my phone number from Lars Ulrich from Metallica, who we came very close. And you got to remember at the time, I didn't have a house. I was sleeping on couches and I got off tour and I went to my mom's, you know, so they tracked me down and found me. That's how much they wanted me.
Really?
It was great to know. So I basically made a career decision based on the fact that at the time Guns N' Roses was the biggest band in the world. So I made a career decision. I joined the band as a member. You know, I was not a sideman, contrary to popular belief.
Yeah. Cause you were with them for 7 years, weren't you?
Yeah, you know, I had to learn early on how to negotiate, you know. I was like, okay, well, I'm already in another band. I'm already in The Cult. And they want me. They tracked me down. They found my number at my mom's house. Where's that taking me? Well,
thank you, Mom.
I'm in a pretty good position to try to negotiate. So yeah. I learned really early on, you know, if you don't ask, you don't get.
Yeah. Well, what's it like getting that call when, you know, your mom comes in and says, hey, there's some guy named Slash looking for you.
Well, she couldn't even pronounce his name. She called him Slut. But later on, that didn't come to fit. But my mom didn't have a clue about rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was still worried about me when I was in The Cult playing 20,000 seaters. You know, it was like, she was like, she didn't really see a future in it. And I think that the lifestyle scared her, you know.
Did it with good reason?
But when I got Guns N' Roses, all of a sudden she realized this is real. This mm-hmm. is like, this band became a household name. Mm-hmm. Her neighbors knew. The whole dynamic changed around me. You know, all of a sudden I was this rock star in this big band. Mm-hmm. The cult was cool, but I didn't feel the real, like, kind of scary, intense energy of, like, you got to be careful who your friends are until mm-hmm. they join you.
Yeah, I can see in my head, the cult was just as big to me. I mean, I was just as big of a cult fan as I was Guns N' Roses. So it's interesting to hear you say that you know, they're the difference.
I think
between
if
you
line 10 people up, you line 10 people up and you ask them those two band names, I would say out of 10, you might get one or two, especially age demographic. Like if you were asked, let's say they're a mixture of ages,
mm-hmm.
but you ask that same row of people about Guns N' Roses, and I'd say 9 out of 10 would say Guns N' Roses. There might be one oddball in there that wouldn't know it, but that's only if they lived under a rock. I mean,
yeah.
Guns N' Roses, that particular name, just the household name. The cult was a little bit cooler, underground, but still a big band. You had to be, you had to be a fan of the music. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like people walk by me every day wearing a Guns N' Roses T-shirt. They have no clue that I was going to be more of the original. Yeah. You know, I was with Johnny Ramone when he was alive. And Johnny Ramone is standing there, the kid wearing a Ramone shirt, and they're clueless because they're wearing the shirt because Ramones is cool, but they're not a fan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. They've got all the T-shirts, the old classic concerts from that they're selling in Target now, and people are buying these and don't even have a clue who they are. So.
Well, they want to identify, you know, it becomes like, oh, I'm wearing a Motorhead shirt. That makes me this for Ramone. Guns N' Roses. I'm edgy. I'm rock and roll.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I had a whole discussion with somebody about the T-shirt and branding aspect of how those things took on a life of their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Motley Crue. That's a whole other discussion, but that's what Guns N' Roses became. It became like, now obviously I'm not in the band. People go to see the concert, and if someone finds out I'm in the band, they'll say, oh, I was at your show last year. And I said,
no, you weren't.
Me up there. You know, yeah. Maybe they got the light dim on the drummer, but I don't know if you realize, but the drummer is actually African American now.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah.
So what was that like for this young kid from LA and getting into this band, and now you're in it? How did your life change besides just the notoriety of it? What was that like to be in that experience?
Well, I mean, you know, as a kid that was growing up in rock and roll, I feel like, you know, I got my dream, right? Mm. Like the dream became a reality more than I ever expected. Because, you know, as a kid, I used to watch movies like Song Remains the Same, Led Zeppelin, and, you know, that scene where they're driving up the limo in the back of Madison Square Garden. Mm-hmm. Well, I remember when we did 4 nights at Madison Square Garden, and we took the limo up that same internal driveway, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm in the movie, you know? And
I'm in the movie.
Literally.
You, that particular time in my career, things got a little scary and a little bit sort of, you know, it was bigger than life. It was, it was a machine. It was a lot of money around it. There was a lot of, you know, people's hands in the pie, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And with any sort of, you know, people think that, you know, you're in a band and you're out there and you're on stage, but there's a big engine behind that. And there's a lot of politics and business and partnerships. And so I got a little confused, you know, I think that it almost sort of was hard to stay focused as a musician with so much other stuff going on, if that makes any sense. When the craft came first, when I was a kid, it didn't really matter about all the ancillary, the money and all that fame and all that stuff didn't really matter. I knew I just wanted to play rock and roll.
Yeah, that was all you ever wanted to do, right?
Yeah, and then when that came along and it got so big, it was, you know, it was like trying to just hold on and, mm-hmm. you know, survive.
But yeah, it's funny to, you know, because you're playing with Billy Gibbons now, and I've known Billy for about 8 years, and my mom went to school and church with Billy, you know, 50-something years ago, and I remember my uncle years ago telling me the story when, because I used to, when I was younger, I'd go and hang out with him and listen to all of his records, and we get to talking about ZZ Top, and he's like, yeah, I remember hanging out with this guy, with Billy Gibbons, and that's all he ever talked about was, you know, I'm going to be a rock and roll star. And it's just, it's been a really cool thing to, you know, 50 years later to get to meet him, and now through him to meet you and to see this life that you guys are part of. And it's just the glimpses of it that I get, I can't imagine, you know, those moments you're talking about driving up in the limo and, you know, to Madison Square Gardens after selling out 4 shows. And yeah, it's just, it's gotta be wild.
Well, Billy Gibbons for me is the quintessential traveling minstrel.
Yeah.
He is the definition of the word vagabond.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a true musician. There's no fakery when it comes to Billy mm-hmm. Gibbons. So I had to go through all the transitional phases of my career to come back to what's really important. When I joined Billy's band, the Big Bad Blues, and we toured it, that was probably one of the greatest moments in my life. Obviously, I'm a fan because I grew up with Tres Hombres and mm-hmm. Fandango
yeah.
and Rio Grande Mud prior to the 80s resurgence of, you know, Eliminator and those records, yeah. you know, Afterburner.
Yeah.
So I came up with ZZ Top in the 70s. So I'm a teenager. Now I'm in a band with like the quintessential blues rock Texas, mm-hmm. you know, now I had to morph again, you know, I'm like morphing, I'm learning from the master.
Yeah.
Now studying what he is about and then being mm-hmm. on a tour bus with him.
What's that?
Go ahead.
No, I was just, I met you through Billy back when you were, when you came through Austin for South By. And yeah. you've got so many other projects that you're doing, and you're kind of the lead guy on most of these, right? You know, like Neurotic Outsiders, that was one of your brainchilds, or
yeah.
And then and Billy, you know, was that just through one of your other projects that you had done, or did he find you, or how did y'all end up hooking up?
Billy initially came and played with me and my band Kings of Chaos.
Okay.
So what happened after Velvet Revolver, you know, I had this other band where Slash and Duff and Scott Weiland, and we were actually very successful. We got signed to RCA Records in 2004. My first Grammy, we got nominated 3 times, sold a lot of records. And we made 2 albums and then the band broke up. And then after that, I'm like, okay, I don't think I got another one in me. Mm-hmm. You know, I was ready to call it a day, and I was really starting to produce. Mm-hmm. I was starting to film soundtracks. You know, I just been in a lot of really tumultuous situations with bands. I don't even want to go into the underlying backstory, but it was about 50-50 love hate mm-hmm. with the business at mm-hmm. that point in my life. I was very sort of disgruntled by being in a partnership with other guys that I just wanted to just kind of shake them and go like, yeah. Hey guys,
yeah.
This is a really good job we have, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. let's just try to enjoy it and not make it so, everything was very dramatic. And
yeah. Well, yeah, I saw an interview with you recently where you were talking about that, you know, like a lot of these guys, you know, they're road guys. That's where they're happy. They want to be on the road. And you commented that, you know, I like that, but I like being home too. And you're doing a lot of other projects that, you know, not just music related.
Well, I think I'm at a point in my life, you know, I'm going to be 60 in November.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at Billy Gibbons or I look at Mick Jagger and I'm like, oh shit, that gives me hope.
Yeah.
You know? Like, yeah. you know, 60 years old in the rock and roll business. I remember when I was a kid and I look at a 28-year-old guy. Yeah. And I go, that guy's old.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but I don't think anyone really cares anymore. That's sort of gone. It's like, of course, the whole modern society is always pressing young, everything in front of our face. It's like, you know, modeling clothes, the girls are like, and model kids are like 16 and, you know, Snapchat and, you know, whatever. But as guys that have built their career based on songs, like Billy, there's an audience and there are people that are out there that want to see us and live with us for our whole career and follow us. So we kind of like, you let that go and you're like, I'm just going to be me, right?
Yeah.
And do my thing. But after Velvet Revolver, I decided I was going to take back control. You know, I was always in a collaboration and there was a lot of letdowns along the way. And I just said, you know what? I'm just going to create my own little universe. And that was hard to do. It was hard to like trust that you could do it on your own. And it wasn't easy and still isn't. But I would align myself with great musicians like Slash and Axl and Scott Weiland and, you know, all the people I played with. So I decided to create my own band. So I created King's Chaos. I decided I was going to be the sole member. I own the name. I run the business. I have a manager that co-manages with me. And I call everybody up and I hire them and I pay them. And they don't have anything to say about anything except for, here's where you're going to play. Here's how much you're going to get paid.
So I noticed that you have just published a book, or it's about to be out, and where a lot of these stories are available for our listeners and your fans and just music fans in general. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Is it actually out yet?
No, we were going to release it in April, and I was supposed to go to New York, and I was going to, you know, promote the book, and obviously...
kind of hard to do that right now.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, obviously everyone's reading books. Amazon, Netflix, and Zoom are the highest winners in this situation. But the reality is a lot of the publishing companies are struggling because, you know, a lot of these mom and pop bookstores, you know, are part of that. So anyway, long story short, book's on hold till next year. And but it's been done. It's been finished for almost a year and a half now.
Wow!
And it took you a while to write it, right? And about 3 years to figure out what you wanted to say and how.
It's a big one. You know, you're going to throw it out there, right? I mean, obviously, I'm telling you sort of condensed versions of what was going through my mind at the time, but. You know, what I tried to do is just sort of encapsulate a life story based on this life I've lived. And, you know, I didn't even really want to do it, to be honest with you, but people kept telling me I had great stories. I was like, well, okay. And then when I started to do it, I had time and I spent about 3 or 4 years starting from the beginning and going all the way up to where I am now. And I just saw just a really great arc of sort of like, you know, when you what you're doing in your life to, you know, hopefully at some point what's the morals of the story? Well, hey, I know I want to have fun, I want to be happy, I want to make some money, and who are my friends and who are my, you know, my family? And then, you know, kind of look at it and go, well, I went through this and this and this and this to get to this. So the book's just a life story, and there's bumps in the road, just like everybody else's life, but I got some pretty good bumps.
Yeah.
There was the one interview I saw with you where you said you were talking about the book, and you said the opening line is you're sitting in jail. Was that?
It can only go one way. Well, I guess.
The book starts them in jail. They just take it from there.
Yeah. So we'll just wait for it to come out.
It starts out with a bang, you know. Craziness, and then it goes back to my childhood coming up in the 60s and the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show and all that, all the way my early years of trying to make it as a musician and then finally success. And the downfall of GNR and at that particular time, the breakup of that band.
Yeah, do you so you go into all the details of all that?
As much as I could legally.
Yeah.
Moving on.
I mean, I hope so. Legally, but no, I mean,
well, I guess we'll find out, won't we?
Yeah. Can we get the advance copy?
The stories that I tell in the book, some of them and most of them are already out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just my version of that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's maybe a few in there that are sort of my personal thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
On all the different scenarios that happened, and that's my personal thing, right? It's like, and while writing the book, I really had a, you know, obviously we all have resentments in life and things that happen to us, and it's somebody else's was part of it. But the reality is, what's your part in it? And that's the way I looked at the book. What could I have done differently, and what could I have done, and how would I react to that now? And it was so much different. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And so I take responsibility for a lot of what happened in my situation with any relationship that I ever had, be it my relationships in life with just partners or musical collaborators or business people or whatever. Yeah.
And that's not always an easy thing to do.
Yeah. Life's a learning experience. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I don't feel like I came off jaded. I just came off with my truth. I just told the story with no disparaging. You know, did I make comments about certain people? Yes. But it's my version of what I saw. Mm-hmm. So that's the book.
Well, and it's from such a perspective at this age to be able to look at all that and see the tapestry and to see the themes and to put that out there and look at your part in it. So. What's the name
of I've always been pretty I've been a pretty open guy, and it's been good and bad for me. The way I sort of, I don't know, I've just never been really one to hold things in. Mm. Like I know a lot of people, and I won't name names, but you don't even know who they are or what's going on inside of them. It's just they just hold it all in, and that must be painful.
Yeah.
I'm like, if I don't talk about how I'm doing or how I'm feeling or what I've been through or to somebody else, but I know so many people that are able to sort of guard themselves like that.
Mm. Yeah. It's not healthy.
And
I'm
interesting.
Like, that's a real trait that I just, so my, you know, like I say in the book, I mean, the way I sort of, you know, dealt with different members of my bands that I've been in, and I'd say, hey man, you know, you're out of line, or, you know, let's you know, that's just how I am as a person.
Yeah.
And maybe when I was younger, I was like, look, I'm going to tell you what I think because this is what I think. And then I learned later on to pick your battles.
Exactly.
be a little bit more, you know, structured in your presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So what's behind the title, Double Talk and Jive?
Yeah, well, that was the title of a song that represented sort of me as a drummer. Like there's pretty much two songs that are most well known for certain drumming.
Mm-hmm.
Both those songs, You Could Be Mine, which was one of my most famous drum songs from Guns N' Roses. I start the whole thing. It's, you know, big drum fill. And it's like the first 20, 30 seconds of the song is just drums. Double Talk and Jive, same. I come in, you know, it's like, but to me, the lyric, Double Talk and Jive, only a fan of Guns N' Roses would really kind of understand the back meaning behind that. But it's like, don't always believe what you hear.
Mm-hmm.
Find the information. Mm. And you're not always going to get what you think you want.
Yeah.
Because there's always sort of a, you know, Double Talk and Jive. Like, I had managers in my career. Man, I love you, babe. You're like family. Man, you're the greatest. We should just, you know, let's go hang out. I love you, man. And then the band breaks up.
Yeah.
And they don't. And they don't answer your phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, when you're in a business where people are going to tell you what they think you want to hear to get what they want.
Exactly.
So that's where the title double talk and jive comes in.
Okay.
And that's human nature. We all want the best from people, right? Mm. We all want how would we do it? And then somebody comes along who you never expected to stab you in the back. And you're like, oh my God, how could that be possible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah. You never saw it.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
You just never saw it coming from some certain people in your life. And we've all had this.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll go, how could they do that? I wouldn't do it that way. Mm-hmm. I can't act that way.
When you can't do it, you can't see yourself doing it. It's hard to imagine somebody else doing that to you.
Surprise.
We all want the best from people, but people throw you curveballs, and you're like, oh my God. So that's the title.
Okay. We'll be looking for it. Yeah. You know, one of the many reasons.
And I'm not looking at this like I'm playing some sort of victim. No, that's not.
You just got some stories to tell.
The point is, man. Life ain't easy. Life on life's terms. You're going to get your ass kicked along the way. If you want any form of success in any field, if it's business or whatever you do, you're going to navigate not friendly people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's business, mm-hmm. right? So that's the book.
Well, and one of the reasons we were really interested in talking to you about, in addition to everything we've talked about, is your transition, your evolving as you got older, as you started doing things more in your own terms, and the engagement that you have with several nonprofits and I guess we call them charities. And we really wanted to hear your take on that. And there's only a couple that we're familiar with, the Animals Asia, the Arts Project, which you partnered with one of my very favorite actresses in the whole world, Jane Lynch. It was so cool to see that. And then the incredibly powerful Dolphin Project. So why don't you jump in with just any one of those and tell us how you got involved and what it means to you?
I started out, I don't know, the charity thing happened organically. It wasn't like I'm going to go out and save the world or any of that. It was totally by accident. I had a buddy of mine. I was working on my first solo album. He was probably the quintessential, what I would call, I used to call him a tree hugger. You know,
yeah.
He was always, you know, he was a guy that was like always trying to help people, man. And, you know, he would be struggling financially on his own, but all he wanted to do was just give back. He's like, you know, when they put me in the ground and wherever we go after that, this is what I want people to remember me for. Long story short, now the guy's in Pakistan helping young girls play guitar.
Hmm.
He lives there.
Hmm.
He was a real inspiration to me. And we started something called Global Sound Lodge. And our idea was we were going to give guitars out. And as I started traveling the world, I was giving guitars to kids in orphanages. I gave guitars to kids through Archbishop Desmond Tutu and South Africa, as a guitar, as this sort of tool of, you know, whatever you're going through, music is the gift.
Mm-hmm.
Take the guitar, play the guitar, get through life, whatever struggle you're having. So I had all these guitars and I was heading down to Haiti after the big earthquake with a group called Artists for Peace and Justice.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to take them over there and basically give them to this shelter. People are going to be able to play guitar and have a little bit of song exchange and just make them feel better, right? That was it.
Yeah.
Well, I got caught in the bureaucracy of all this sort of like taxation of, you know, the nonprofit, and you forget to bring them. So anyway, I had all these instruments, and my neighbor had two kids at the public school, and she came up to me and said, "What have you been doing?" I said, "Well, I was supposed to go down to Haiti to do this charity thing." She started talking about the public school system and that there's no music and they're cutting the arts. I was like, what? So I walked up the street to a school that I now am a big part of. There was an old piano and kids had no instruments. public school system was in complete disarray when it came to funding any kind of music program. So I formed Adopt the Arts with my partner, Abby Berman, about 9 years ago. I ended up down talking to the superintendent of schools. We created a plan. And since then, I've donated over 1,000 instruments. We've been together for 9 years. We've been scaling it up, doing more and more schools and adding teachers. Mm-hmm. So I've been heavily involved in that. And then I got involved in the Dolphin Project, became a board member. I traveled to Japan.
So you've actually been to Taiji.
Yeah. I've been to Taiji. I've been to Taiji. So I don't know. It was like a phase that just kind of overtook me. I can't even say why.
Yeah, that's the part I'm most intrigued about you is, you know, your background and your lifestyle and what you've done. And, you know, I'm that tree hugger guy that you're talking about, you know, and when I met you and found out about your involvement with the Dolphin Project, that's when I really, you know, obviously my love of music and meeting amazing talent, but that element was so cool for me because that's my life. That, you know, I'm a professional scuba diver and underwater photographer, and that those kind of things are the biggest part of my life. And seeing somebody like you that has a platform to get that word out is so cool. And that's what I want to be able to do. I want to build my name up to be able to, you know, get the word out on these projects and, you know, to let people know, you know, what's really going on, you know, like with these, you know, swim with the dolphin things and people think it's completely harmless, but it's not. It's it's a brutal, just in my head, evil venture. And yeah, so I'm curious to hear more about what you're doing with that.
Well, like I said, I've been very fortunate to meet Rick O'Berry, right? So what happened was I was in Mexico and I was in a hotel in Cabo and I was overlooking, from my room, I could see a swimming pool filled with about 3 or 4 dolphins. Mm. And I remember I could see them swimming, and about every day at around 8 a.m, the park would open. And people would filter in and start to swim with the dolphins and take photographs with them. And I watched those dolphins all day when I would kind of go come back. And I'd see that the same 4 dolphins were in that pool from 9 o'clock till 6 o'clock at night with 200 to 300 customers coming through there being, you know, and I was just mortified with the way that, you know, there they were in the hot sun. A lot of people don't realize this, but dolphins can get very sunburned, and they do get sunburned. Mm. And they're very intelligent creatures. They're a pod animal. They grow in a family unit. You know, the pod is a family. Uncles, aunts, grandmothers, matriarch, you know, the young ones stay in the pod. They stay together for life, basically. And so I got online and I basically did the contact on Dolphin Project. And I found out about a whale that was down in Argentina. Kazimank was his name. And he was in a small swimming pool. And
what kind of whale was this?
He's a killer whale, whale.
Yeah. Mm.
So you got to remember a beach whale. Like, they say, oh, they were rescued. Mm-hmm. Right? He used that as a way to trick the public into believing that whale cannot be readapted back to the ocean. Yeah. So they take advantage of that particular rescue, and now they have a captive creature that can be worth, you know, into the $1 million range for one orca, because now they have an orca whale that they can sell the sperm and create other, you know, captive births of other orca whales, which SeaWorld has done on the meat. SeaWorld has whales all over the world creating new whales that are born into captivity. Mm-hmm. Now, whales that are born in captivity cannot be released, but this particular whale, Cajamine, can be reintroduced to the ocean. Once he's rehabilitated, same with dolphins. dolphins that are being captured and put into captivity and ripped from their family, mm-hmm. taken from their mother, from their aunt and uncle, are forced to be starved to learn tricks, to be fed, so people can come through and take a photo of themselves saying, I swam with dolphins, mm-hmm. when they pay upwards of $300 to have that experience, when the dolphin's the one that's suffering.
Yeah.
A sonar creature living in a swimming pool with other dolphins, not from his family or her, whatever the sex of that particular dolphin is a really scary thing for a dolphin. Mm-hmm. They're in a habitat that is a sonar sound, a bouncing sound. So their whole way of traveling within the water is all based on sound and sonar, mm-hmm. click whistles, communication between the pod. A lot of people don't know this about a dolphin. It's a dolphin's brain is exact same shape as a human. It's more intelligent. It's more emotionally capable of understanding what it's going through. Mm-hmm. And their awareness. And when you see a dolphin saving divers, their emotional capability is that they truly love us.
Yeah.
They understand what's happened to them, but they're able to take that emotion and not be violent about it, which is the craziest thing. Mm. Now, the killer whale, the orca, which is in the dolphin family, that's a different story. There's been no study of an orca or a killer whale ever killing a human.
No, it's never happened.
Wild.
In the wild. It's happened in captivity.
The only reason it's ever happened in captivity is because they're forced to live in an environment that makes them crazy.
Yeah, and that's my point of it. It's not hostile. It's because of the, you know, the way they're forced to live. Yeah.
And when you see what happened in Blackfish, that particular whale was captured, mm-hmm. maybe down, tossed around like a pet into different parks, killed three people along the way. And the rest is history. It's like SeaWorld is a multi-billion-dollar corporation trying to trick you into believing that this is some sort of therapeutic thing to teach people about whales and dolphins, which is a complete misinformed public. The place to see dolphins and whales is in the wild, living life that they were given by God's gift, which is this earth.
Yep.
And guys like Rick O'Berry, he's started in the 70s and he's an activist of the purest form. He doesn't have the big office. He doesn't spend money doing an NGO that says, look at us, we're doing great work. Rick O'Berry is on the ground at almost 80 years of age. He is 80. Mm-hmm. And travels around the world. He actually got kicked out of Japan because they know what they're doing is wrong. But the thing about Japan is this. It's not about Japan. It's about the people that are causing the problem, which is 45 fishermen that each one of them makes over $2 million a year selling dolphins to the captive industry.
Really?
The rest of the Japanese people aren't to blame. This is a very small group of people that my first day in Taiji, they pulled 10 bottlenose dolphins out of the water at $150,000 a piece, sold to China, Dubai, no longer accepted in the United States, flown on airplanes, hours, 10 hours on an airplane. And that's $1.5 million in one day. Mm-hmm. I watched it happen. Mm-hmm. And it was devastating to see the families ripped from, and I tell people, don't go to a dolphin show. Don't swim with a dolphin.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that's going to stop
it. Yeah, it's the only thing that's going to stop it.
The one thing that's positive about this pandemic is a lot of these parks have shut down, right? And the only issue is, where are these dolphins going to go?
Yeah.
With Dolphin Project, we've created sanctuaries. We rescued four dolphins in Bali that are now in a sea sanctuary, learning how to eat live fish, and then we'll reacclimate them to the ocean. Mm. They'll leave and go out and hopefully find their pod.
Yeah.
And we've done that in South Korea. We've done that. Got two dolphins that have been reintroduced back to their pod. It is possible. Yeah. So I love Rick O'Leary. I believe in the organization. I'm on the board. I want to see the end of this. Just like elephants and Barnum and Bailey's when they outlawed the hook, the elephant hook. This is barbaric, old school. Let's entertain the public by captive animals that are basically tortured for your entertainment. Just wise up. Don't do it. Forget about it. Watch TV. Go to do whatever else you got to do.
Or go see them in the wild. Yeah. If you want to, if you want to swim with dolphins, you can actually go out and do it in the wild and not be, you know,
a threat.
With social media and public awareness, the fact that we can all see what's going on, like what's going on in the United States of America, the fact that we're there and people are watching, that I am a believer in this too will end. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a new era of no animal abuse, especially this entertainment of these beautiful crustaceans and
They're making progress. So it's, we're getting there. But
thanks to people like you, Rodney.
It's just education. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a pretty positive note to wrap this up.
There's so many other things we could talk with you for hours. But
you've been very gracious with your time, and it's been something we've been looking forward to for a long time. Thank you for the great work you're doing, and for all the entertainment that you brought over the decades.
What's next for you when all this is kind of hopefully going away? What's the next project?
Well, me and Billy made an album this summer.
Is that done?
Well, it's done to the point where we're going to mix it. We're going to get it fine tuned, if you will. But we spent a great amount of time out in the high desert. I brought Billy out to a place called Pioneer Town. And my friend's got 140 acres out there with a bunch of Airstream trailers and four houses and two recording studios. And man, we were going kind of nuts. And I was really worried more about Billy than me. And I'm like, man, I got to get you out here. And, you know, we were really like, we all got tested and went in there together and basically quarantined. And made music because I don't know if we could have survived it if we didn't. You got to do something. Like, you can't just sit here.
Yeah. It was nice at first, but now it's like, you know, let's get back to things. So it's.
Yeah. And I'm excited for everyone to see the album or hear the album. We shot a bunch of content. You know, I said to Billy, I said, Matt, let me run with it, Billy. I'll help you. And we shot four videos making of the record. So we're having conversations now about what the best timing is to see if we could kind of wait this out a little bit, but put it out and then hopefully go tour some smaller venues. Also, we got another video coming out from the last album because I don't know if you saw Rolling and Tumbling or Missing Your Kissing.
I put that out.
I actually did.
Yeah, we put that out in April and it like brought this whole resurgence to the last album. So the record company called me and they were like, Matt, you got any more footage? And I'm like, well, I got, maybe we can get another one out of it. Let's see. So we did that. And then a buddy of mine had this, idea to go shoot another video on Hollywood Boulevard. So we went down there a few weeks ago and we shot a video for Hollywood 151, which will be coming out next week. So it's the album from almost 2 years ago. But we're like, who cares? Let's just do it. So we're putting it at Hollywood 151. And then we got another video for Rolling and Tumbling, which should be coming out before Christmas. And then hopefully that'll roll right into the next album. And musically, that's what I've been up to. And that's been great because I just love Billy. And I just want to help him get from point A to point B. You know, I'm there for him and a team player, you know. And I'm perfectly happy with him calling it Billy F. Gibbons, and I'm just there.
Yeah. When this is all done and you start touring, get back over to Austin.
Yeah. We'd love to have you.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know if you saw the Music Cares thing I was involved in, and I had the Austin contingency in there.
Oh, yeah?
Mike Flint, Pete Valley, we did the Music Cares.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
I put that together with Kathy Valentine, who lives in Austin.
Uh-huh. Go-Go's.
Hugh Fowley, Mike Flanagan. They all performed in this thing for small clubs. Mm-hmm. The NIVA Association, NIVA, which is the National Independent Venue Association, mm-hmm. to help keep these small clubs going through this pandemic. Because
There's
no way to keep the lights on.
Being affected. Yeah, the rent. Exactly.
So,
thanks for all you're doing for the environment and for music and for us in this last hour and for hanging in there. We really want to thank you. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the conversation and for everything you're doing. So that's amazing.
Yeah, man.
So
thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, Ronnie, we'd be remiss if we didn't thank a few more people, like our our producer engineer.
We know
Brock Glenn Thomas, who saved our bacon today as usual. Yeah, thank you. And we want to thank Rupert Neve Design for our wonderful equipment here. And we want to thank Donovan Frankenreiter for our intro and our outro music. So until next time, this is Passports, Please.
What a wonderful world, you know this.